You've just tuned in to Embodied Solidarities, 3CR's all-day broadcast for Disability Day. For the next half hour, you're going to hear an interview with autistic disability activist Sean Bickley. Sean discusses the labour exploitation of disabled people in so-called Australia, with a focus on the issue of wage theft by Australian Disability Enterprises, or ADEs. Sean is educated on disability and access issues on three continents and organised the first successful city-level campaign to ban sub-minimum wage anywhere in the world, in Seattle in 2018. Sean is campaigning for an end to sub-minimum wage for disabled people in Australia and has created an open letter which you can sign onto as an individual or endorse on behalf of an organisation. We'll supply the link to the open letter on our website. So without further ado, here's the interview. And thank you to the 3CR Thursday Breakfast crew for originally airing this interview.
My name is Sean Bickley. I am an autistic disability activist and advocate. I'm probably most well known for my advocacy against sub-minimum wage. I organized the first successful campaign to end sub-minimum wage on the city level in Seattle in 2018. I also organized the ban against sub-minimum wage in the U.S. state of Washington, as well as some other legislation, jurisdictional legislation in the U.S. It's important to me. One, it's something that I am interested in and understand, but it's also, it's really frustrating because the opportunities that we have as disabled people to work are already really constrained. And with the government putting so much money into a segregated and discriminatory system, that constrains our options even further. On top of the fact that it creates these really obviously discriminatory and unfair outcomes for the people who have to work in them.
As I've mentioned, Australian disability enterprises function as this segregated employment pathway for disabled people. And this is separate from what's termed open employment. And it's enabled by the Supported Employment Services Award 2020. And these enterprises most recently came under quite a significant amount of scrutiny in the Disability Royal Commission, where the labor exploitation of disabled people in so-called Australia was documented in pretty distressing detail. So can you tell us about the purpose of ADEs or sheltered workshops and who operates them?
Yeah, so the policy behind sheltered workshops actually comes from the 1930s. It's a policy that was adopted from the United States, where these were created by the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938. And the original rationale behind it was beneficial in a sort of patronizing way, you know, that these people can't get employment, so we're going to create these employment opportunities for them in a protected, sheltered, segregated environment. But, and Australia adopted this policy itself in the 1950s. But the reality is that this has not worked and has never worked to provide employment opportunities for disabled people. So, Australia and the United States aren't the only international jurisdictions that do this. It's done in other former British settler colonies, such as Israel, Aotearoa, New Zealand, Hong Kong, a few others, I suspect, but those are the only ones I know for sure. So anyway, since the 1980s, disability providers have been phasing these out voluntarily and replacing them with more effective systems such as supported employment and customized employment. Customized employment is where you create a job for an individual. Supported employment is where someone has support at work, such as from a support worker. And that's used in the Australian context also in a euphemistic way, a lot of times to mean sheltered work and ADEs, but it doesn't have to mean that. And we'll get into the funding structure in a second, but it just means that someone is supported at work to do the job. And these things have been really successful. So since 1996, international jurisdictions have begun phasing this out legally, not just voluntarily. But Australia is very behind and hasn't done anything in the 28 years since then. So it's still completely legal across all jurisdictions in Australia.
Yeah, and I appreciate you breaking down some of the differences in types of employment scheme that might exist that actually, you know, allow disabled folks to work in open employment, but with support, or work in jobs that are tailored towards their needs and requirements in open employment versus being in these sheltered forms of employment. So can you tell us about the kinds of government subsidies and funding structures that these enterprises are eligible for in Australia when we're talking specifically about sheltered work?
Yeah, I'm personally not a fan of euphemisms. So, you know, Australian disability enterprises are a euphemistic term. They're rebranding of sheltered workshops, but they are legally sheltered workshops. That's what they are. That's what they are known as internationally, and that's what I tend to call them. But as far as the funding streams, without getting into the specifics of individual funding, which can change, at a federal level, there's a lot of money that goes into these. One, ADEs, or at least most of them, are tax exempt. They receive direct federal funding for a second. They directly underpay their workers, so they're paying them as little as $3.01 an hour, even though the federal minimum award wage is at least $24 an hour. They utilize their workers' NDIS funding. So to go to an ADE, you have to have NDIS funding, and you receive funding that should be used, is supposed to be used to support you in the workplace. The last thing is they also benefit from community goodwill. So people will assume that if they're buying goods and services from this group, that they're benefiting disabled people as opposed to helping CEOs profit from exploiting disabled people. But there's also, they also tend to get local benefits as well. They tend to benefit from subsidized rent or peppercorn leases, complimentary and discounted room hire in council venues, council rate exemption or discounted rate, and favorable consideration tender and procurement processes based on community goodwill. So there's a whole host of benefits that they're receiving both at the federal level and at the state level. So additionally, I've contacted through the campaigning that I've done every member of state and federal parliament, as well as every councillor in the country. And I've received back variations of the same letter from Minister Rishworth, and they've spent between $57 and $59 million. They've given me inconsistent figures into shelter workshops in the last budget. And I don't know why they would tell me this like it's a positive, like I'm saying, hey, these things are bad. Disabled people don't want them. And they're like, actually, we put $59 million more into propping up this this failing industry. So there's a specific on, you know, additional direct funding that they received in addition to the baseline that they were already receiving before.
I mean, it's eye-opening to hear not just the direct federal government funding that these enterprises, that these sheltered workshops are getting, but also that really important kind of gray area where they're perceived as a charitable enterprise. And so they get access to a variety of community goodwill, you know, initiatives that also prop these organizations up. And yet I'm thinking of the words of the CEO of Inclusion Australia, Catherine McAlpine, when she was talking about the fact that so much of the funding that goes into these organizations, because they engage in, I guess, what we can call wage theft from disabled folks, it actually just goes to support everybody else at these organizations, you know, in the higher levels, rather than actually going directly to the people that are doing the labor. So going to that issue, can you talk a bit more about how these sheltered workshops actually function? What's your experience been, and what do you know of other people's experiences in these kinds of organizations?
There's a few different things to unpack here. The way that these are justified is that someone is paid a percentage of the prevailing wage based on their productivity. So the prevailing wage may actually be higher than the minimum wage. So if the prevailing wage is, say, or whatever job is $30 an hour, somebody could actually be paid higher than the minimum wage, but they're being paid less than what they should be paying because they're being paid a fraction of the prevailing wage because they have a disability. And this is generally determined with time studies. So it's something like if they're packing widgets into a box and the expectation is that they need to pack 100 widgets in a minute and they only pack 50, they're going to get 50% of the prevailing wage. There's a few problems with this because when you go to Kohl's or Woolies, no matter how slow the cashier is, they're still going to get paid the exact same wage as any other starting cashier. And people tell me, oh, well, you know, they could lose their jobs. Da, da, da. I'm like, no cashier loses their jobs for being too slow. I've been in too many checkout lanes to believe that's a thing. And it's still it's still an equity issue there. Two, the way that these are set up are often very unfair. So if you're waiting on somebody to deliver the widgets to you and nobody's doing it, the clock is still ticking and that's still counted against you. It's really anxiety producing. If you can imagine having someone with a stopwatch looming over you at your job and any time that you're chatting or that you're not working or any mistakes that you made are being counted against you, that's going to hurt what your pay is for the next year. And then lastly, like, who determines what the normal rate of pay is? So you can take three non-disabled people who are 20, 40, and 50 and get three completely different rates of speed. And so obviously they're going to choose younger, experienced people to determine what the normal rate of speed is. So somebody could actually be faster than a typical non-disabled person would be, but they're slower than the arbitrary normal rate that's been chosen. So that's kind of how those things are structured in theory, because then you get into things that aren't things that could really be determined with a time study that are still being determined this way. Now, we get into some issues here because ADEs are not the only places that that pay some wage. They are the majority. So this model is based on the idea that of putting people into bad job matches, right? So the only way this is legally justified is that you're being put into a job that everyone knows is a bad match for you, and you're not going to be able to do the job at capacity. You're going to be doing it at 25 or 50 or 80% of capacity. And therefore, that is why they have the legal authority to pay you under rate. But this isn't how non-disabled people are put into jobs, and this isn't how modern legal practice since the 1930s and since the 1950s works with disability and jobs. So like when most people look for a job, they look for something that matches their interests and their abilities. It's not like, oh, you're born in this town and you have a disability, therefore you have to go work and do shredding because that's the only job available for your kind. Regardless if you're good at it or you're so bored, you're going to end up being really slow after a while. So it doesn't match what people's abilities are. And in a modern context, we look at employers having a legal obligation to make accommodations for people. There's none of that with this because it's completely incompatible with modern disability law, modern human rights law, and treaties that Australia has signed that say that they need to make accommodations for disability. This ideology is, we're not going to do that. We're just going to pay you a fraction of the minimum wage. But putting all that aside, let's suppose that you are in a shelter workshop and you're doing a job that you're not a good match for and you're not going to be able to meet the capacity. You have NDIS funding and you have a support worker who is there to assist you. So they're getting a two for one. You know, they're getting federal funding and they're getting tax breaks and they're getting a second, presumably non-disabled person to do this task for you. So they should be able to pay you the minimum wage because they have two people doing this job. But instead, what happens is that funding is used to pay for general operating expenses and for management. And I know this happens in, you know, multiple occasions because providers have told me this, not in a way that I can prove it or in a way where it's someone who is trying to be a whistleblower and I don't want to, like, burn them. But this is a thing that happens. The other thing I wanted to address while I'm thinking of it, is it's not just ADEs that are doing this. There are three Now, four local councils in Australia that directly employ disabled people and pay them a sub-minimum wage, and the council profits off disabled people's labor. Three in New South Wales and one in WA.
It's absolutely shameful to see the extent to which this is normalized, both culturally and in terms of, I guess, like government funding structures, that makes me think about this broader context of being in a, you know, in a disabling and ableist society that applies austerity politics and logics to disabled people to, you know, magic up some idea of ideal productivity, rather than actually addressing the needs and desires of each person and taking into account their agency and individuality as a person. What you've mentioned about the NDIS funding is also particularly galling in the face of, you know, increasing government crackdowns on what's an appropriate category of thing to spend on. And yet you see this double up where these sheltered workshop organizations are effectively able to extract that extra amount of profit. I wanted to turn to the campaign that you're running to end the practice of paying people with disabilities sub-minimum wages. So how has this campaign sort of come about and what have you achieved so far? You mentioned that you had written to a whole lot of politicians about this already.
Yeah, well, as I mentioned before, I organized a couple of prior campaigns overseas in three different jurisdictions. And those were comparatively easy. But the way that award wages work in Australia, it's not possible to ban it in a city or state. It has to be a federal ban, or it has to be something clever with a funding structure. There are ways that a state or a council could pass legislation if they wanted to address these sort of things. It just wouldn't be an outright ban. When I tried to plug into sub-minimum wage activism in Australia, many of the peak organizations weren't doing it. All right, many NGOs weren't doing it. Some that were doing it, for example, Inclusion Australia, were also doing a lot of other things at the same time. And I basically pulled together a letter with the help of other disabled people, and I was trying to get signatories onto it as a beginning base of political support to see, you know, what organization supported it, where support was, where support was strongest, that sort of thing. And I had a really difficult time getting organizations to sign on because of the peak organization structure. A number of peak organizations wouldn't do it unless it was a peak organization approaching them. One of them wanted me to surrender the list to them. And I was like, well, nothing's stopping you from just doing this yourself. And you have staff. You could contact all these people faster than I could. So I ended up opening it up to public signatures. And once I had like 1,000, I had more credibility to start getting more signatures on. So at this point, I've got 36 national organizations, 208 state and local, 17 senators and MPs, 41 state and territory MPs, 115 councillors, and 2160 individuals. So the reality is, you know, a list like this is not necessarily going to be enough to motivate change. The Labour Party is, from what I can tell, really committed to expanding sub-minimum wage. I know that they had or have a pilot program in Northern Territory and Northern Queensland to look at putting NDIS recipients into shelter workshops. The list of things that are NDIS supports came out last night, and I've only glanced at it, but on the draft list, they had shelter workshops as something that they were going to fund, even though they're not funding plenty of other employment-related things. So even though that they're cutting, you know, they just cut $14 billion from the NDIS, and they're cutting huge amounts of things that people need to sustain a reasonable life, they seem determined that they're going to put more public funds into shelter workshops. So I think it's going to be, I think this is something that they're very supportive of. And I don't have much leeway with the coalition either at this point, which is funny because in the United States and internationally, the first political party to support this was the U.S. Republican Party, which is not that surprising because if you take people out of shelter workshops and they're being paid a minimum wage, they're less dependent on pensions and more able to pay taxes. So there are absolutely reasons why conservative parties would support this if they thought about it for 2 seconds. But at the very least, this gives us, you know, a cross-section of who our allies are, what organizations are supporting this, and what areas we have identified support and where people are supporting.
I appreciate you breaking that part down and talking about what you've been doing. What's the next step for you and how can people support this organizing?
That's a great question. I've been attempting with support to try to organize this into a nonprofit just because I feel like it might have more credibility with major parties if I, you know, if we were able to contact them as an organization and not as Sean Bickley, some random person in Queensland. But there's a lot of hoops to jump through for that, even if you're looking at not running programs, but just being a group of all disabled people doing disability advocacy, which is what I would want, something, a board of only disabled people doing employment advocacy. There might be more opportunities depending on who's in government federally. I've sent about 20,000 emails. I've emailed all of the NDIS organizations and all the current councillors and MPs, except for whoever just got elected in the New South Wales elections. It just happened. So, I mean, some of it is just kind of waiting for better conditions, but also identifying, you know, who is supportive and trying to get more intermediate steps passed, right? So there are a couple of councils, particularly in New South Wales, where councils are more amenable to taking sorts of intermediate steps, which I haven't really gone into. But for example, a council could choose not to provide peppercorn leases and subsidies and preferences to ADEs. There are a number of international jurisdictions where councils, which don't set a minimum wage of their own, have passed legislation that they will not pay minimum wage themselves and they won't do business with entities that do that. And that's something that council levels are completely able to do. And I think that if we could get a number of councils to start doing that, it would sort of be like the signatures. It was very difficult to get the first couple of signatures, but once I started getting, you know, hundreds and thousands of signatures, it became really easy. If we can get a couple of councils to start passing that, others will start copying it, and it will be much more difficult for these to operate if there are a bunch of cities that they're not legally able to do business with the city government, at least. There's also something to be said for probably creating pledges for businesses to voluntarily sign on and choose not to do business with these entities if the government is not going to step into it. It's just a lot for me to try to organize, but I'm happy for people. And a lot of the people who are supportive don't necessarily have capacity or experience to do these things themselves other than to support or try to assist. But you know, there are a number of things that could be done on a local level. If people live in one of the four councils where the council is paying subminimum wage, are you okay with this? You know, can this be brought up? Because, you know, the council definitely has money to pay those 12 people a minimum wage. They're just choosing not to.
It's an immense amount of work that you've been doing. And I really appreciate you emphasizing that. You sent 20,000 emails already to providers. You've been in contact with MPs. You've been growing this groundswell of support from a variety of different government representatives at local government, but also at state government, and then across these organizations, across the nonprofit sector. We'll have a link to the letter in our show notes as well. But I think what I'm understanding here too is that once people are aware of how these organizations, of how ADEs or sheltered workshops operate and where they operate and the way that they do exploit disabled community members, it's an imperative on all of us to start sounding the alarm and demanding that there's a change, and that there's an end to these sub-minimum wage practices. Is there anything that you wanted to add before we wrap up?
Not that I can think of right now. It's a very involved system. A lot of the questions you asked me were, in order to explain this, I have to explain something else. But even though the mechanics and the money trails are really complicated, the issue itself is not complicated. You know, disabled people have been really clear, both in Australia, internationally, across the board, through the Royal Commission, through this letter, through many disability organizations, of what we want, and that's to receive equal pay and not to be discriminated against. And I think that most people who are not profiting from the system automatically know when they hear this that it's wrong and it's exploitative. So regardless of how complicated the mechanics of who's profiting from this are, it's really simple to do the right thing and make sure that people aren't being exploited.
That was disability activist Sean Bickley. We will put a link to the open letter that Sean has created as part of his campaign to end subminimum wage for disabled people in Australia on the 3CR website at 3cr.org.au/Disability Day 2024.
Everybody, you know how it is. You heard him. You heard her. Go rub your man. Go rub your girl. And hold her tight for the hard love done.
Hard love.
Again. Yeah.